Welcome, everyone, to another session in the Meeting of the Minds monthly online book discussion group. My name is Tom Peters. It is Tuesday, January 18th, 2005, and tonight we're discussing the novel, short novel, Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton, first published, I believe, in 1911. I admit I haven't read much of Wharton's work, some of her short stories. I think I've read one, maybe House of Mirth. And I don't know too much about her life, but I think she was born into a wealthy New York City family, pretty much lived her entire life in the upper classes, among the upper classes. My understanding is that she had an unhappy marriage, and at the time she was writing this novel, she was actually estranged from her husband, and I think she was living in Paris when she wrote this novel. What I do know of her works is that she typically wrote about high society or fashionable society, urban society. And so Ethan Frome, being sort of a rustic, rural, poverty-stricken tragedy, is a bit of a departure for her. So with that little bit of the introduction, let me ask first the big question. Did you enjoy the novel?
I didn't like its ending.
You mean the fact that after they attempted sort of a dual suicide and ended up both crippled and being cared for by Xena?
That's right. That just wasn't the way it was supposed to be.
So what do you think the message is in that, Pat? Do you think it's don't go sledding at night, or don't let your mind stray from your spouse, or don't flaunt social convention, or were they just star-crossed lovers, or what do you suppose? Why did it end so? It's really a pretty bleak novel, I think, beginning to end.
Yeah, it really is bleak. You know, it's hard. It's really hard to say. With a wife like he had, I can understand anything. But right is right, and morals are morals. And it would have been better to just plain divorced her and married the girl he loved, apparently. So I guess that was my take on it. I thought it was a strange novel. I just thought it was really strange.
Jill, were you going to say something? I didn't hear it if you did.
I'm saying I must like strange novels, because somehow or other this novel really grabs me. And I don't think she was trying to talk about moral values or anything. I think she was just saying, this is kind of the way life is, folks, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, life certainly dealt Ethan a tough hand. If I remember all the facts right, he was kind of a technological, what we would call today a geek, I suppose. He was kind of technologically proficient. He'd gone away to trade school. He was kind of doing well in his studies. He had hopes of going to Florida and getting a job. And then, if I remember the facts correctly, first his father got kicked in the head and kind of went soft in the head, is I think the way someone described it. And then after he died, then his mother kind of was spent years as an invalid. And then Xena, I guess, if I remember correctly, remember all the facts straight, it's been a couple of weeks since I finished this novel. Xena then came to care for Ethan's mother in her sort of dying illness, prolonged illness that ended in her death. And then they married, and then about within the first year of their marriage, then Xena sort of comes down with her mysterious ailments. And so pretty much since he was sort of a promising young student, a technical student, Ethan had a pretty tough row to hoe, as they say in Iowa.
Yeah, I considered this book more a tragedy than anything else, really.
Yeah, I did too. I saw it as sort of like I read some of Thomas Hardy's novels, and kind of that rural tragedy where people just don't have a lot of opportunities, and when a few things go bad, suddenly their lives are just miserable. So what did you make of Xena? Does she have any sort of endearing or redeeming qualities?
I guess her redeeming quality was she reveled in taking care of sick people.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that way. I mean, she was so sort of sickly while Ethan and Maddie were having their, I don't know what you'd call it. It was tough to call it sort of a love affair because they never really consummated anything. They were sort of like kindred souls or something, kindred spirits. And then once she, once they had their big smash up, then she cared. She sort of snapped out of her doldrums. What I still to this hour, I don't know exactly what the nature of her ailment was, Xena's ailments, but she sort of snapped out of that, and then she cared for them for years and years. It sounds like.
Can you imagine what it would be like to live in a close environment with three people like that?
Yeah, I think it would be. I mean, in a way, it's sort of like Ethan's reticence is, and the way he sort of smolders between beneath the surface, or however we want to describe it, is probably a direct result of that household he's been living in for all those years, and his sort of thwarted ambition. And I think maybe a third thing is just the climate. I mean, it's really kind of, I think Wharton portrays this as a very harsh climate. It always seems very wintry and cold. There's never much springtime or summer in this particular environment, it seems to me.
That's one of the things that impressed me about this book, too. She literally makes you feel cold, doesn't she? Like you'd like to snuggle up to a nice warm fire. I mean, she's a wonderful descriptive writer.
Yeah, and in her sort of author's introduction, she talks about how she really wants to, she wanted to really write a simple tale. She didn't want to make it really complex, and she thought that would almost be doing an injustice to the characters with their stark lives. And I was sort of impressed by the style of Wharton's writing and her portrayal.
Do we really think, though, that it is truly a classic?
I don't know. I didn't have to read it in high school, so if that's maybe a an indicator of what's a classic and what isn't, I didn't have to read any of Edith Wharton when I was in high school.
I didn't either, but I'm glad I didn't in a way, because, you know, it just doesn't seem to me that this particular story had the earmarks of what I consider a classic, but obviously maybe my thinking of what a classic is a bit undefined at this point and not really very, very good.
It happens to be on a list of books, quote, called for college-bound students. I saw this list, my granddaughter is working from it, and what is interesting to me is that even though this book was written early in the 20th century, it doesn't really have that old feeling to it to me. I mean, you know, you could pick this book up now and not be put off by the writing style, I think. And of course, because I like this book, I think it's a classic.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that a lot of novels from 1911, from the first decade or so of the 20th century, if we picked them up today and read them, they would seem very stilted or quaint. But this does have sort of an enduring quality about it, and it does seem fairly modern. And I don't think Wharton sort of pulls any punches either. It's always a little bit tricky to try to read into what the author really thinks about her characters. But, you know, of this love triangle of Ethan, Xena, and Maddie, where do you think Edith Wharton's sympathies lie? Well, I'll dive in since I asked the question. I mean, I think that she really sees Ethan as kind of a tragic, but in his own way, sort of a noble character, that he's been sort of like squashed by life and circumstances, but that, you know, even though he develops an affection for his wife's niece, I guess Maddie is. You know, and it's sort of a in a vacuum, we would say that's not a good man. That's not a good thing for a man to do, for a husband to do. I think that Wharton sees him as really kind of a noble character.
Well, and as you said, I mean, they hadn't done anything. I mean, he hadn't consummated or anything. With that wife, I think he did remarkably well.
I agree. And I also agree with your point about it being a classic, too. That's a point very well taken. It seems to me that I did not know, I haven't taken the time, I'll confess, to read anything about the author. So what you said, Tom, at the beginning, if she was estranged from her husband at the time, this probably was saying more to us than just the story itself, you know, saying more about her feelings as an author, about the tragic, you know, the uncomfortableness and the wanting for love and happiness, and certainly Ethan hasn't been able to find it anywhere.
So I just want to ask again, I mean, I didn't see anything sort of redeeming about Zena. I mean, she does seem to care for the sick well, but you know, during the main part of this novel, when I guess Zena's about 35 and Ethan is 28, he's considerably younger than Zena, and Maddie must be in her late teens or early 20s. During that time, part of the novel, that time frame of the novel, when they're all three living at the farmhouse before the big smash up, I just couldn't see anything in Zena. I mean, she seems kind of suspicious, but she holds her own thoughts and you know, never confronts Ethan if she does have any suspicions, and seems kind of focused on her own ailments and kind of always looking for a doctor or a quack or some kind of a medicine that's going to help her. I just couldn't see much to like in Zena during that main part of the novel.
I didn't either. She, to me, is a true hypochondriac. And I honestly thought that even her, quote, caring for the two after the accident, I really think that, you know, in my mind, I thought, yeah, she's probably just lording it over them and making life miserable for them.
Yeah, I thought that too. That was almost like a psychological domination, or you know, the physical caring was also kind of a psychological domination, or a form of prolonged retribution for their rash act or something like that. Although I'm wondering if there's anything really in what happens there at the end of the novel that supports that. But I had that same feeling, is that she was kind of lording it over them in her own way. You know, so if I see this as, you know, I see this as a classic love triangle, and also sort of a classic rural tragedy. And I think some authors have sort of been interested in sort of that inarticulate or semi-articulate rustic tragic situation. I'm thinking of that ode written in Thomas Gray's ode written in a country churchyard. I don't know if you ever read that poem. And then like Thomas Hardy's novels from the late 19th century, early 20th century, just before Wharton's time. And also even some of D.H. Lawrence's novels, like Lady Chatterley's Lover, where you have that gamekeeper who's sort of a rustic fellow and barely articulate and has sort of minimal life chances. He's divorced or separated from his wife. And there's other authors, I'm sure, that have sort of dwelt with this kind of rural poverty and just sort of not many chances in life, and how, you know, when something happens, especially when something bad happens, you know, it has long-lasting repercussions. It's, you know, you're not socially or geographically mobile in these places, especially at the time this novel was set. And I mean, I think that sort of adds to part of the whole tragic situation. I can understand sort of, I can understand Zena's mentality, I think, and I can understand Ethan's mentality. Of the, if they, if you agree with me that this is basically a love triangle, I have a hard time understanding Maddie. She also had her problems, and I guess her father died, and then they discovered that he was left them financially destitute, and they had, I think they had to declare bankruptcy, and then her mother got ill at that and died pretty quickly. So she was sort of, I guess, an orphan. And she sort of came to them as almost, I think at one point Wharton says that she was almost like an indentured servant. The thing I don't understand about Maddie is, you know, was she really a soulmate? I mean, did she really, was she really drawn to Ethan as like her soulmate? Why didn't she, you know, she had sort of aspiring suitors in the village, but she didn't seem to give them the time of day very much. Why did she do that? What's up with Maddie? Did she really think that she loved Ethan and she was just a star-crossed lover, or what's going on with Maddie?
I certainly think she loved Ethan. That was what the problem was, and that's why she didn't get involved with anyone else. And you know, at the end, I guess I consider this what you said about Thomas Hardy. I agree. And these are what I would consider these a fatalistic type novel. You know, that's just the way life is sometimes. There's no people seem to want books to end with these happy endings. You know, life is seldom that way.
Yeah, I think we're sort of used to, you know, a lot of motion pictures try to wrap everything up in a nice, neat package at the end, and it can be sometimes frustrating. I agree. Sometimes life just doesn't work out that way.
That reminds me of a survey that I recently received from some publishing company. I don't know what it was, and the one thing they were asking, one of the types of in the category of romance, did you want a happy ending? You know, and I laughed when I read it, and then I thought, well, you know, I guess we do, and maybe, I mean, many do, and maybe it's because, you know, we all have trials and tribulations and concerns, some much worse than others, and maybe that's what we seek in the books that we read, is kind of the unreal, if you will, because truly it is an unreal situation because life isn't fair, and we do have to accept challenges. So maybe that's, you know, that's part of what all this is about. I really thought that Maddie too did love Ethan, and being so very young, she wasn't exemplifying as much wisdom as we thought. I wasn't sure that Ethan was aware of what was going to happen. You know, she was pretty sure that they would be killed, but I just didn't know if Ethan really realized it or thought he'd be able to miss the tree.
Oh, I think his whole intent was to hit the tree. The bad part about it was that he didn't quite manage to kill them. And after all, she was the instigator of it, but he went along with it because he couldn't see any out either.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jill, is that, you know, it really was Maddie who sort of first broaches the idea of this attempt at a double suicide. And Ethan at one point sort of was entertaining the idea that, well, maybe they could just run away, and I think he talks about in sort of in vague terms about going out west and starting over. And I can't remember exactly why they move away from that notion, but it's as I recall, it's definitely Maddie who sort of says, let's just end it all here, and it would be sort of the perfect ending to our star-crossed love.
Tom, I remember when they were talking about going west that he didn't think he would be able to sell the farm and get enough money to be able to give his wife some to do for herself with and still have enough for him and Maddie to do what they needed to do out west.
Oh yeah, that's right, David. Now I recall. Yeah, they didn't. He didn't. He couldn't even sort of get enough capital together to run away, basically, from this sort of intolerable situation. And so, again, that for me, that just sort of reinforces this notion that this is a rural, poverty-stricken, tragic novel, that these people are just sort of stuck where they are in this sort of destructive situation.
Does it follow the same theme, if you will, that other authors of this period followed? I don't know that I've read enough of authors in this period to know, but it seemed like it just seemed sad and morbid.
Well, I mentioned Thomas Hardy, and he was really, he wrote quite a few novels about tragic situations, rural situations, and he was also very keen on the effects that circumstance or happenstance, fate, if you will, could have on a person's life, how just what seems like a little event in a person's life can change the entire course and tenor of that person's life. So certainly Hardy, who was writing a little bit before Wharton, just chronologically, I see as very much in sort of in tune with the tone and the themes of this novel.
Wasn't Hardy writing actually quite a bit before her, because he was before the Romantic period, as I remember it. Is that right?
I don't think so. I think he's late 19th century, sort of late Victorian author, and he lived into the 20th century. I know he wrote some poems about World War I, so he's at least still active around World War I.
I don't think I've ever read any of his works.
That's right. And that's amazing, too, isn't it? Because his style certainly seems older compared to hers, much older. I mean, his whole themes, but like Return of the Native, for instance, I remember that was required reading in college. And I've read other books since then. Very different from her, I thought, in his material that he was using, but not in the type of descriptions that he was doing. Certainly that same fatalistic, you really have no control, but very different in style.
Yeah, I agree. Another thing, sort of as I started this novel, I imagined what it was going to be about. I sort of knew the basic story, and I thought that there'd be more in the novel of sort of the villagers ostracizing Ethan and Maddie for their soulmatedness, or their I don't know how to describe what their relationship. But you know, having read the novel, I just didn't get a sense that the village was sort of the moral force here, and that they were angry or disappointed in Ethan's behavior. I didn't get that sense. What do you all think?
No, I thought that they really understood why he did what he did, actually.
That was what I was going to say. I thought they more condoned the relationship rather than look down upon Ethan for his feelings toward Mattie.
Yeah, especially that Mrs. Hale who runs the boarding house. I mean, at the time of the main action of this novel, she's a young woman and she has a young beau, I forget his name. And so they're almost like foils to Ethan and Maddie, because they're like the perfect couple, not this star-crossed couple. And if I remember correctly, Mrs. Hale is the first one to come upon the scene after the sledding suicide, I guess you'd have to call it, sledding suicide attempt. And I think she said that like Ethan and Maddie said something, but she doesn't divulge what it is. And she's always kind of reluctant to talk about it. But as I recall, she was the first one on the scene after the accident. I mean, it seemed to kind of lead add a somber tone to even her life, you know, for years afterwards, because here she was, this, you know, young woman in love and going to get married, and then there's this other couple in town that are on kind of a parallel path, and then suddenly she comes upon them and they're, you know, mangled, and you know, her, we can only guess at her reaction to that, but based upon her reluctance years later to even discuss the incident, it seemed to have had a profound effect on her.
I felt, you know, that was the case, and your feeling or your description of her reaction is accurate. And no, she never did divulge what she heard or saw, I guess, or heard would be in this case.
So David sent me an email message, and he was commenting about how the weather is like a real force in this novel. It does seem, as Jill said, it's like the novel actually gives you the chills. I guess I've never really read a novel that was so, although this is a short novel, that was so sort of, the weather in it was so such an unrelenting presence, and just it puts a chill and a damper on the whole action, it seems, from beginning to end. I guess there's that one scene that they recall where it was like a summer picnic by a lake, and that's where really Ethan and Maddie first sort of realized that they had that their soulmate was in the other person. But other than that, it's a pretty, the weather is like a, it's more than just a symbol, it's like a presence, it's almost like a character in this novel.
It really is, and it casts the gloom and the despair and all of the, negative feelings that one has, and intensifies it. I hadn't thought about it, but, you know, David is correct. It really is, and you were saying it really is a very strong presence and almost a character, and that's pretty good.
I've never been too much into symbolism, but I think there are some pretty strong symbols in this novel. It seems like Maddie is always wearing like a bit of red about her, like a scarf or bit of ribbon in her hair or something like that. And she's, you know, well, did anybody else notice that? What do you think that signifies? That she's really has this sort of vibrant color about her.
I thought it denoted youth and, you know, her effervescence, her enthusiasm for life, and really being a bright person, while his wife was just doom and gloom all the way through. And so she was really a bright, you know, a bright spot in the whole picture.
Yeah, that's the way I interpreted it too, that she was sort of a, almost like a splash of color in a very somber scene. And she's young at heart, as well as, you know, just chronologically young and vibrant and full of life. And, you know, Pat, you were talking about how the ending kind of seemed all wrong to you and sad. Remember after the smash up, how I can't remember if it was Mrs. Hale or someone else says that Maddie really kind of lost all her brightness, and she really kind of turned, I forget the word that was used, like sour or something, understandably, if she's, based upon what's happened to her. But, you know, this really, you know, she almost became like, more like Xena than herself after the accident.
Yes, she did, and that too, you know, added to the tragic ending, I think, for me. It just that the whole picture seemed reversed, but it wasn't a very satisfactory reversal.
Another maybe a key scene in this novel is where Xena has gone off to the neighboring village in search of a new medicine and a new doctor. And Ethan and Maddie are home alone, at night eating supper, and you remember Maddie pulls out a pickle dish, I think it is, to sort of brighten up the table. And I don't know if she was consciously realizing that she was pulling out a prized possession of Xena's or not, but it gets broken by the cat, and the cat's almost like Xena's presence in absentia. And you know, what did you make of that whole scene where the pickle dish gets broken?
I thought it was interesting, especially when you pointed out about the red. I think that pickle dish was red, so she just liked bright things, and maybe it was a sort of foreshadowing of their relationship being smashed.
Yeah, good point. Hadn't thought about that the smashing of the pickle dish sort of foreshadows the sledding accident, or coasting accident, they call it. They called it back then. I have to say, though, I mean, I know when you read a novel, you have to sort of suspend some judgment and things, but I just have a hard time imagining two adults who decide that they want to commit a double suicide would choose sledding as a way to do it. I just had a hard time with that. I don't know. Did anybody else sort of say, if you want to commit suicide, sledding is not the, you know, your chances of committing a double suicide by sledding are pretty slim.
Maybe they were determined to make it look like an accident. And speaking of the suicide factor, I wonder how this book plays in Japan, where that is more standard in that culture, if this was popular over there.
Yeah, I don't know, David, how this novel has fared in other cultures. I just don't know. Anybody else have any sense of Wharton's reputation in other nations and other cultures?
I don't, but I did find it interesting that Jill's telling us that it's on the college list, you know, a pre-college list of reading. That seems strange to me.
In a way it does, but in a way, when I think about some of the books I read in freshman English, The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, which I thought was ghastly, and it was, his sentence structure is so convoluted that it had some gothic elements, and it was short, so maybe this is sort of in that same thing. And some of Theodore Dreiser's stuff, I think, is rather bleak. I think it was the one, maybe either Carrie, or there was another one where somebody drowns, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Sister Carrie's a pretty bleak novel, too. Maybe there's a kind of a bleakness about this early 20th century that maybe there is kind of a bleak theme that, or tone that goes through a lot of the novels from the first 20 years or so of the 20th century.
I just finished reading a book that I wouldn't recommend particularly for us to read, but it was a book of an Indian and his wife, and they made their way to the mountain that he kept talking about, his mountain, Lights Mountain, and then they lived together in happiness, and then they were killed. They got under, he was dying, and she didn't know it anyhow. And so they were out for a walk and went under a tree, and lightning struck, and they were both killed. But, you know, somehow that seemed all right, because they would, neither one of them would have made it well without the other. And so, you know, while it was tragic, that kind of an ending seemed okay for suicide, but it wasn't deliberate suicide, but for death. So I don't know, it's strange. Of course, the way the way this particular book was portrayed, it was so bleak and dismal all the way through that I guess you just kept hoping that it would brighten up and something nice would happen.
Speaking of suicide and hoping, you know, and not quite always understanding them, I just thought of a book I'd kind of looked at once by Scott. No, it was by Helen Meering. I think she and her husband Scott were very popular sort of environmentalists in the 60s and I think 70s, and he decides he's lived long enough. I think he was almost 100, so he quit eating and starved to death. I don't know how you do that. I like to eat too much, so I'd have to pick another way. But it just seemed weird. I mean, there was nothing wrong with him. He just felt like he'd been around long enough. I'd want to be around as long as I could, because I'd love to see in, say, 60 or 70 years what the world would be like, and would it be better?
Yeah, I'm with you, David. I like to eat too much, and I'm sort of curious about what the world's gonna look like and be like in the coming decades. You know, coming back to Ethan, you know, he's a pretty inarticulate guy. You know, he never really even opens up to. He never has, seems to have a heart-to-heart talk with his wife, and he doesn't seem to have much of a heart-to-heart talk with, even with Maddie. And he does have a lot of inner yearnings that just never sort of get articulated or acted upon. Do you think if Ethan had been a little bit more of able to express himself a little bit better, that this tragedy would not have occurred? Do you think it would have been a totally different person if he'd been a little bit more of an extrovert?
I would think so, because if he had really, quote, stood up to his wife and not let her have her way, she might have even been better, been different, had he done it early on. And certainly if he'd expressed his feelings to Maddie, I suspect they would have found a better way to end their lives than in being maimed for life.
Yeah, but there really wasn't any better way they could end their life in the situation that they found themselves. I mean, that's where the real tragedy comes in. What else could they have done? They couldn't have gotten a divorce, like David said. There was no money. He had some concern for his wife. You know, he couldn't just walk off and leave her. I just don't see how it could have been handled any other way.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that there are just so few options given their situation, I think is, as you say, Jill, really part of the crux of the tragedy here, is that they just, it's not like they had a lot of choices and they made some bad choices. They just didn't have a lot of choices, it seems to me.
That's true, as I think about it. And I guess that is more of a sign of the times than we, because, you know, I still hold to the old values, but I know much of our generation, current generation, does not. And they wouldn't bat an eye in leaving her, the wife, you know, stranded and just going willy-nilly off. But Ethan was, you know, was a good person. And so I guess you're right. They really didn't have the options that, and I'm not sure we have those options today, but we take them.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. And you know, I agree that we talked early on about how her style is really, you know, much fresher than other books, other novels written around this time. It sort of has worn well, so to speak. But in another sense, I think the, you know, we're almost 100 years now beyond the time of the writing of this novel, is that I think it's difficult sometimes for readers to sort of project themselves back to a time where divorce really was not sort of the commonplace it is today. And I read somewhere that every year 10% of the American population moves. One out of 10 people every year move to a new location, whether, you know, it might be within the same area, but they move. And you know, we're this novel set in a place where people didn't leave, and I think it was Harmon Gow, the carriage driver, who said that the smart ones got away, and then the ones that sort of got stuck there, either through their ignorance or lack of education or circumstance or, you know, any combination of those, they just sort of have to survive. They can't get away, and they're just kind of stuck there.
Does that make, I agree with that, and does that make Ethan a weak character? It sort of did in my mind. As I read through, he really wasn't forceful enough to make any change. He accepted his fate and just kind of tried to, quote, make the best of it.
Yeah, he's pretty passive, it seems to me, and maybe that's part of his tragic flaw, is that he has the, you know, he certainly has some skills and aptitude. He was not made for farming, it seems like. He, you know, I think at one point somebody says his love of nature did not extend to agriculture, you know, and he's, I grew up in a farming area, and I know there's a lot of, there were a lot of farmers who, you know, were kind of stuck farming, and they didn't really enjoy it, and I think Ethan was kind of stuck too, and whether that's a flaw in him or just sort of a fatalism in his character, I don't know, but he really, you know, there's kind of the tragedy, part of the tragedy here is that he was, he had some potential, he was vibrant, and then whatever, you know, his father's early death and then his mother's early death, and then he sort of married the wrong woman, I guess you'd say, and the marriage didn't turn out well. And by the time we see him, he's sort of been crushed or broken by these circumstances, and he's sort of withdrawn into himself, it almost seems like to me.
I'm not sure that I've noticed, but how did they manage to live, the three of them, after the accident? He certainly wasn't in a physical, position to do the farming.
Yeah, I was wondering that too. I mean, if they were in such dire financial straits before the accident, how did they manage? I guess they've lived 24 years in this post-accident domestic triangle, but how are they making any, you know, how are they making ends meet? Again, this was, you know, there's no mention of insurance. There's no mention of Social Security. I mean, this is not the age we live in.
And I suspect usually you're taken care of. I mean, you know, we've been told that in bygone days you were taken care of by your family, and obviously these people didn't have any family. So I wonder if it's implied that the villagers took care of them, and that would even be a more of a blow to a person's self-esteem.
He probably took any odd job he could get and do, you know, just like when the man said, I think he would be happy to get a dollar from you for taking him to the train. Imagine that's the kind of things he did. And maybe, you know, he did it on shares, did the farming on shares, or the wood cutting on shares with that man that he had helping him, something like that. We don't know, but certainly no welfare.
Yeah, somehow they managed to survive. Hey, one other thing I wanted to ask you all about is, you know, whenever you have a narrator who's also a character in the novel, you sort of have to ask the question, do I trust the narrator? Is the narrator sort of giving me a complete and accurate picture of what's happening here? And then did you trust the narrator? Did you think he was a straight shooter?
I hadn't given it a thought, to tell you the truth.
The narrator was certainly interested in Ethan right from the very beginning, just his manner, his stoicism, his, you know, the whole thing. So I certainly trusted him. But, you know, this was the one thing that bothered me about this book. We never were really told how he learned all of the things he learned. Do we assume that Mrs. Hale told him all these things later on? Because, you know, here we got him at the house, and he could see the situation. And then he said, you know, basically, this is what we know good and well. Ethan didn't sit down and tell him this life's tragedy. So how did he really learn it?
Yeah, I guess it's a good question. I don't have the answer, but I guess he sort of pieced it all together by talking with Mrs. Hale and Harmon Gow and Ethan when he spends the night there because of the snowstorm. I guess, I don't know exactly, but I guess I would say because he sort of pieced it all together based upon what he heard from sort of various versions and various snippets of this story.
That would almost be the only way that he would have, since he, you know, as I recall, did not know the family beforehand. But certainly this was the talk of the town. And I can appreciate the villagers would have given anyone that was interested an earful of information about the three people and their current, their prior lifestyle, if you will, to the, you know, prior to the accident.
Well, I don't, I'm trying to sum up here. I enjoyed the book. I guess I've read enough somber novels that they don't give me the, you know, put me in a funk or anything like that. But it certainly is a bleak novel and stark, you know, very, very kind of classic simplicity about it. I don't know where I'd put it in terms of my, you know, top 100 novels or something like that that I've read in my life. But, you know, I think it's a good novel. I'd recommend it to others. It's got us, tells us a simple tale and tells it well. And I think certainly the tone of the novel matches the action of the novel. As I forget now whether it was Jill or Pat mentioned early on that the style is still remarkably fresh, almost 100 years later. You know, and I think that it's sort of a indelible image once you've read this novel, that this love triangle and Xena and the whole village scene and the sledding accident. I mean, and Ethan as kind of a tragic character, I think is, you know, a memorable character in literature, like Huck Finn or some of the other, Jay Gatsby or some of the other characters we've read about. That's my kind of semi-articulate summation. Anybody else want to try to summarize their thoughts and feelings about this novel?
I don't think I can add anything to that. I think that pretty well does sum it up. The author certainly did, you know, define characters well. And you either liked or hated them, I guess. Had respect for or didn't have respect for. So the characters were really pretty well portrayed and acted within the bounds that you would expect them to, except Xena at the end, caring for, of course, I interpreted that she did it, well, probably, again, no options, but also to, just to show her supremacy over them, and this was a wonderful way that she had of, quote, getting back at, if you will, Ethan.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm no psychologist, but I think when Xena was kind of in her sickly phase, that was, you know, I think that she had a lot of phantom ailments myself, and that she almost sort of used her sickness as a way to deal with her situation, that she was in a loveless marriage, and she wanted to sort of manifest some kind of psychological control over Ethan, and so she, maybe she had some ailments, but almost like she allowed them free rein, sort of psychological free rein, because the situation, that sort of helped her deal with her situation. Once the tables were turned and Ethan and Maddie were laid up, then she pretty much just snapped out of it. And you know, who knows whether it was conscious on her part or not, but she, at some level, she must have realized, okay, the entire situation is different now. I can't continue to be an invalid because that doesn't help me in my situation. And so she just sort of snapped out of it and became healthy again. And again, I'm just kind of speculating because this isn't really brought out in the novel, but I sort of see it as like she had to figure out a new way to sort of manifest some sort of control or domination over Ethan and now Maddie. And the way to do it was become healthy and to nurse them.
It also gained her attention. And I thought the hypochondria with all of her illnesses was just to gain attention. And so this right about face reversal that she maybe had to do because she didn't have any other options either. But anyhow, it still was something about her character that she was getting attention that she needed, that she apparently craved very much.
Boy, you know, I'm almost creating a little bit of sympathy for Zena here after talking about this novel for an hour. I'm kind of wondering if she's almost as a tragic character as well, that she's just, you know, didn't have a lot of talents and skills, and she was kind of coping with her situation in the same way that Ethan was trying to cope with the situation.
And also, don't you think she was just terribly bored, and that's the way some people deal with boredom, they become hypochondriacal. When the accident occurred, that gave her really something definite to do.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of just snapped out of it and said, okay, well, I got to take care of these two people. And that kind of launched the next 24 years of their intertwined lives. Well, anyway, any final thoughts? Interesting novel, and interesting discussion. Next month, I think it's Wednesday, February 16th, we're going to discuss a nonfiction work, The Difference the Disability Makes. So that'll be hopefully be another good discussion. Any final thoughts before we call it a night? I'm going to go take some more cough medicine and go to bed, I think, and try to beat this cold.
Well, this will be a personal note, not about the book, but my computer is being taken away tomorrow, Tom, so I'm not sure how long it's going to be gone. They don't know what's happened to it, but I'm having some major problems, and they're picking it up in the morning, so I'm just totally devastated. I'm going to try to use one of my others to do, you know, be in the library online programming, that some of those programs look so good, and I don't know how long I'll be without my computer. But I enjoyed reading the book, so I thank Jill for suggesting it. It was something different than I've ever read, and so I found it interesting.
Yeah, I did too. Like I said, I haven't read much by Edith Wharton, and she's a good author, so that's a good thing to know. Well, thanks everybody, and have a great evening. And yeah, Pat, I empathize. I've had major computer problems in the past, and boy, I just feel lost and almost sick to my stomach when that happens. And you know, it's too bad. I feel sorry for you.
It's really the first time that it's happened to this extent, and all my passwords, all my addresses. And especially with the symposium coming up, I'm just totally devastated because everything is on this particular computer. I have two other computers that I hope I can use, but I I don't know. I may have to take a Valium or something. No, I don't take medicine like that. I don't even have any.
Yeah, I know. It's. I once had my hard drive crash, and I think I wandered around for about a half a day, just about in a daze. I was just so... all the stuff I'd lost, and so makes me want to go back up my hard drive here real quick. So thanks everybody, have a great evening.